The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Forum, the weekly program in which we bring prominent personalities to the microphone to discuss important topics of the day.
This is Edgar Lustgarten in producing today's London Forum, and the two members of Parliament who are our speakers. Anthony Crossland is Labour, and before his election, he was a lecturer in economics at Oxford. Reginald Maudling is Conservative, and before his election, he was head of the economic section of the Conservative Research Department. I'm telling you these little bits of their past history because it has a considerable bearing on the problem we're going to discuss, Britain's economic problem. For several years back, you know, average people have thought that Britain's economic problem could be summed up in two words, dollar gap. But today we're being told that the dollar gap is closed, and in the same breath we're being told that a serious, grave economic problem is still with us. And what most people here would like to know, and what I imagine quite a lot of overseas listeners would like to know, is this. If we have indeed solved the dollar problem, if we have indeed closed the dollar gap, what exactly is the trouble now? What are we up against? Crossland, do you think you could start by throwing some light on this for us?
Well, I could, but before I do that, I would like to emphasize just how completely, for the moment, we have solved the dollar gap. The increase in our gold reserves between 1949 and this year, and the change from a very large deficit on the dollar account to a natural surplus in the first 6 months of this year, it does seem to have been a quite spectacular change. And it is, in fact, due to a considerable extent to the policies of this country. It's sometimes said that Britain has contributed very little, and that it's all to the credit of the rest of the sterling area. In fact, if you take the first 6 months of 1949 and compare that with the first 6 months of 1950, you see that the United Kingdom contributed more to the improvement than the rest of the sterling area.
Now, Crossland, I notice, says that is due to the policies of this country, and Maudling, I take that to be a delicate way of saying it is due to the policy of the Labour Party. What have you got to say about that?
I also took that to be his meaning, and I'm grateful for his delicacy as between one opponent and another. I would be the first to admit that the change in the state of our gold reserves has been dramatic. And I would also admit that I was wrong in not anticipating that it would be so dramatic. And I think it's one up to Sir Stafford Cripps that he was right, and most economists in this country were wrong. Personally, I think it is attributed rather less to the policies of the government than to the activities of enterprise in this country, 80% of which still remains, as we know, private enterprise. But I do think it is unwise, you know, to overestimate the degree or to know the permanence of the closing of the dollar gap. And you said, Carlson, just now, that in the first half of this year, the United Kingdom contributed more to the improvement in the dollar situation, the gold situation, than the rest of the sterling area. But isn't it also true that the improvement was very largely in invisible items of payment? They're not invisible trade. Our balance of trade in physical, visible items got worse in that period.
Well, I think that's true if you take the British balance of payments with the rest of the world, but if you just take the dollar gap by itself, although invisible certainly improved to a great extent, it is very important indeed, the main part of the improvement in our actual dollar balance was in the visible figures. And the main part of that, in fact, was due to import cuts, both on the part of Britain and on the part of the rest of the sterling area. In fact, dollar exports have gone very well in the last few months, and I should hate to claim the sole credit of that for the government. I'm perfectly prepared to share it, in some degree at any rate, with private enterprise. But the main part of the improvement between the two periods, so far as dollars were concerned, was in import cuts. And I do very strongly think that these import cuts, which have been decisive, wouldn't have taken place but for government policy and but for government controls.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, because the import cuts have been true, carried out in this country, but also in the other dominions. And the other dominions have made a very great contribution indeed, often at great inconvenience to themselves. Take Australia, for example. I believe much of the present inflation in Australia is due to the fact that they exercise very great restraint over their dollar imports. If they'd have more dollar goods, they'd have less inflation. They did play an immense part in solving or helping to solve temporarily this problem.
I don't want to introduce into this extremely generous discussion any note which might lead to bitterness, but I want to put this question to Crossland, and that is this. Supposing that a Conservative government had been in power during the period in which the dollar gap has been in fact closed,
Do you think, and here we come down right to brass tacks, do you think that Oliver Gap would have been closed?
No, I'm quite certain in my own mind that it wouldn't have been closed, just to introduce an edge of controversy. I think that for two reasons. Partly that I don't think that a Conservative government would have been willing to control imports as ruthlessly as, in fact, we have done, and as, in fact, has been proved necessary to closing the dollar gap. And secondly, I don't think that Conservative governments would have been willing to operate their controls on the home economy, on private enterprise, sufficiently ruthlessly to compel as large a proportion of our total production, our total output, into the export markets as, in fact, we have achieved.
Role modeling?
I often think, you know, the ruthlessness of the exercise of controls really is conceals incompetence in the administration of them. I don't really believe that this exercise of internal economic control has had much to do with it. But if I can come to another point, what worries me is this, that as our balance of payments improves, always our internal price problem seems to get worse. A world inflation, world rising prices, seems to coincide with an improvement of our gold reserves. But world falling prices means that our gold reserves get worse. But we have this dilemma. Either we're going to have a balance of payments problem or an inflation problem. We seem to be moving now from the problem temporarily of the balance of payments to the problem of new and renewed inflation. That's what worries me. Would you agree with that?
I think that's very true. I think that the dilemma is very, very much as you stated. Although, just before I say a word about that, it's well to remember that the improvement in our dollar balance between the first half of 49 and the first half of 50 in fact took place before Korea and before the world rearmament boom and before the present commodity boom reached its the extreme limits of the last 2 or 3 months.
Yes, but there was a short-term covering of commitment, a short-term bear covering, I think the economists call it, from that period, which died away in the middle of this year.
Yes, that's quite true. But at any rate, it did precede the fantastic commodity boom that's going on now. And as I said, in fact, the improvement was largely due not to our earning more by our exports so much as the decision to cut imports for various reasons.
Anyway, Crossland, this gives us an opportunity of putting the question again, which I put to you at the beginning, and you were kind enough to say you would answer later. And that was, what light can you throw on the new problem that's before us? What is the new British economic problem?
Well, the new British economic problem, and I think that Maudling would agree with me here probably, is now not for the moment the problem of how to settle the dollar gap, not for the moment the problem of our foreign trade at all. It is the problem of the impact of rearmament on our own economy. And certainly not merely the impact of rearmament in this country, but also the impact on us of rearmament in America, for instance, which is having the effect of driving up commodity prices to their present level. That seems to me the present problem. I don't think that Maudling and I would disagree on that at all.
Is that in fact agreed, Maudling?
Yes, I think the problem of rising prices in this country, and I think in most other countries, is the most important problem at the moment. Various factors contribute. One, the long-term effects of devaluation, which are now coming home completely to roost. Secondly, international competition for raw materials. Thirdly, internal competition between the demands of rearmament and the demands of the consumer. And fourthly, wage claims, which I think must be granted to a considerable extent over the next few months.
Is this cost of what the average person would put in the terms of cost of living?
This is certainly what the average person would put in the terms of cost of living, I agree. And to the average person, it certainly is by far the most important immediate problem that he's concerned about. I think, though, that it's only part of the general problem of how Britain in particular, and if it comes to that, the rest of the world, is to finance an additional large burden of rearmament. It seems to me that the cost of living is part, in a sense, of the wider problem. And although the burden manifests itself in a rising cost of living to a considerable extent, I think one ought first to discuss just where the rearmament is coming from, where the resources that we're now going to spend on rearmament are to come from.
Yes, indeed. One of the things I thought perhaps we might discuss even before that was how far this problem has gone up to now. For example, how far has inflation reached? Would you, Maudling, say that it's gone a very great distance?
Well, there seem to be two opinions about how far inflation has gone, or in other words, how high prices have gone. One is the opinion of my wife, who tells me that prices have been going up very fast, and I agree with her when I go to the shops. The other is the opinion of the Chancellor of Exchequer, who told us in the House of Commons this afternoon that the cost of living has only risen by about 2% a pound.
Then there's the cost of living index, which keeps going down and down and down, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's rather sensitive point to certain members of the opposing party. Perhaps you might ask Crossland whether he thinks the cost of living is going up or down, or perhaps both at once. You never know. It's
well, Crossland, Maudling, first of all, you posed a very difficult problem because you faced me with a choice of loyalties. I have to side either with your wife, from a last I don't know, but from afar I admire, or with my own sponsor, the Exchequer. And it is a particularly difficult problem. So far as the cost of living is concerned, I don't think, in fact, there is any doubt that, at any rate, taking a few months together, it is going up. I certainly don't dispute that, nor do I dispute that it's an absolutely vital problem. What I would say about inflation, in respect of this rise in the cost of living, though, is this, that the reason why our cost of living is going up at the moment in this country is almost entirely due to inflation abroad and not to inflation at home. I shouldn't say that we had any inflation at home now. I think that we're just suffering from the effects of inflation in other countries, and certainly will continue to suffer for the next few months.
I do not doubt that. I should say the pressure already of competitive demand between manufacturers for metals, for example, and other material for the increased rearmament program has had some effect, and the increase in wage rates, which has gone on and is bound to go on to some extent, to an increasing extent, is already having an effect in this country, in that it's putting more money in people's pockets. If you have more money in people's pockets and less things for them to buy, then you get rising prices, as I understand it. That really is, do you agree that that's what inflation really means to the ordinary housewife or citizen?
Well, I agree that if you have that situation, then you'll have rising prices, but I don't really agree with your analysis on that. The rise in wages in this country in the last year has been infinitesimal. It's been far lower than anybody expected when these things were discussed after devaluation. It's been far lower than anybody then expected. And really, wages have been pretty constant in the last year in this country. There is a certain competition, I agree, amongst manufacturers for raw materials, but I don't think as yet that may become a serious problem. At the moment, rearmament hasn't had much effect on this country.
Well, you ask them in Birmingham, Mr. Gerard, I think they'll disagree on that one. You ask people who are trying to fabricate aluminium, what's happening about the demand for raw aluminium. I think it's already got underway. And so far, very few firm contracts for munitions, as far as I know, have been placed. We're just in the early stages of the rearmament demand. And I think that will come upon us, or ought to come upon us, very soon, rather drastically.
Well, it seems to me the position we've reached is this, that whether we get it by infection from abroad or whether it's a homegrown product, we are agreed that there is a certain degree of inflation at the present time. And now, modelling the point you're just making brings us back to what Crosland was coming to a few minutes ago, and that is, how do you pay for rearmament? Crosland, you were about to make that point, and I would like you, if you would, to do it now.
Well, I'm glad to make the point, although I'm bound to make it in a form which, at any rate, gives some credit to the present government. I think that the only thing which makes rearmament an even bearable burden for us in this country is the rate of increase in our productivity every year. It's really fantastic there. That year by year, our total output is going up by, well, we can quarrel about the figures, there are disputes, but it's going up by something like 5, 6, 7% a year. This is just about double the rate at which it went up before the war. I personally think this is very largely due to rearmament plus controls. I think that that's what has produced this basically healthy economy, and I think that owing to this rise, we are at any rate in a position to pay for rearmament, probably, without any really significant cut anywhere else, in other words, out of our increased production year by year.
Well, I wish I could agree with that. I think it's a very difficult problem, which I've been trying to understand. I don't believe that production has increased by as much as 8 or 9% as it's quoted. Undoubtedly, it has been going up and will continue to go up, though the rate of increase is bound to be slowed down, partly by raw material shortages and partly by the upset of converting factories from making motor cars or whatever it may be to armored cars or tanks. That is bound to slow down the increase in the rate of production, therefore will slow down the increase in the national income. And I doubt if we will produce enough over the next year to meet our rearmament requirements without having to cut back on other forms of consumption. Certainly in some physical items, sheet, steel, timber, and these things, there will have to be a diversion from manufacture for civilians to manufacture for the armed forces. See, we can't avoid that.
Well, but you say that we've got to have some increase in consumption, but then what sort of an increase in you said we've got to have some sort of a fall in consumption, but where is the fall in consumption to be felt? Because you did say some time back that you thought that wages ought to go up, for example. It is rather difficult to see how you should have a fall in consumption, and yet at the same time say that wages are bound to go up and should go up.
Well, it's difficult, but it's, I think it seems to me some of the economic facts of life. And the wages are going up in this country as they are in every other country in the world for the next few months. And as for reducing consumption, there are bound to be fewer motor cars, fewer radio sets, fewer pots and pans. Everything that takes either metal or metal fabricating capacity is bound to become more difficult to acquire if our rearmament program is going to be as big as I fear it's got.
Modeling, tell me, a few economic cliches are now going round in my head as they have done for years. Is this anything to do with too much money chasing too few goods?
I think that was the Labour Party's cliche of 1947, but they rather tend to change with the times, we all do.
But isn't it a fact that if you're going to pay higher wages and have fewer consumption goods, that is what happens? Is that right, Foster?
I still thought so, but then you must address that to Maudley.
Have addressed it to him, but I haven't got an answer which I can understand.
In other words, if you want more of one thing, you've got to have less of cover.
Are you suggesting, Maudling, that we should have cuts then in consumer goods generally?
I think we'll have to have cuts in consumer goods, because if the factories making pots and pans switch over to making aircraft parts, and they'll have to in the next few months, then there'll be less pots and pans, unless you can step up production very dramatically, which in any case, I think the shortage of raw materials at present prices will make quite impossible.
What do you think about this, Cross?
I think that's overstated. It's quite true that you'll certainly have cuts in things like television sets, motor cars, refrigerators, and the other things which you, Maudling, were mentioning. I don't doubt that at all. But my general point is that however much you argue about the figures, one can't get away from the basic fact that productivity is going up by a good deal every year. And therefore, although you may have cuts in certain sectors where you've got direct competition, certainly, with their armaments orders, nevertheless, you'll still have an increase in production in other sectors just by the natural increase in productivity. So it isn't necessarily true, and I don't believe it will be true, to say that taking the home market as a whole, you'll get some significant fall in the number of goods in the shops.
Well, you know, this scares me. I don't believe we can have rearmament without tears in this country. I don't believe we can get the arms we need to face the size of the present Russian armed forces without feeling it. Feeling pretty severely. I may be wrong, or it may be professional pessimism, but I can't help feeling in my bones that we're going to feel this rearmament if it's going to be a real and genuine thing.
Well, if you really feel that, and I certainly think you should feel it, I don't think one can have it, of course, in an entirely painless manner, but I still do think, as I say, that there won't be any significant cuts, probably, in home consumption. But if you do feel this, I should have thought that you ought to go to the trade unions and say, well, now look, in this situation, no wage increases at all. We must have an absolute wage freeze, say, and possibly increases in taxation and the like. That ought to be the set of conservative t-shirts in 1950.
No, I don't think of...
Rather, if I may say so, than 300,000 houses.
That's not a cliche. That's 300,000 houses, which is the name of it, rather, as we shall see if we have the opportunity. But I don't think to maintain a complete wage freeze is possible. I think it may well come to increased taxation. I'm not for a moment afraid of facing that. I think it must come to reduce government expenditure. And you've got to maintain a substantial budget surplus if you want to keep prices in check at all. I don't think taxation can go up by much. It may have to go up by a little. I think the only answer can possibly come is reducing the expenditure side of the budget if things aren't going to get out of control altogether.
Can it be done, Crossman?
Well, it depends entirely what modelling means. It's very hard to say in those general terms. Clearly, nobody disagrees with the statement that we must have economies if we can. And we must be looking for economies the whole time. But it's really very difficult to answer that point without saying whether he wants cuts in the capital investment part of the government budget or whether he wants cuts in the social services part or what part he's thinking of.
Well, perhaps you'll amplify, modelling.
Well, this is an old and familiar argument in politics in this country and probably most other countries. No one wants cuts. Everyone wants to spend government money because it's nice to give people things or let people have things. But you've got to choose. If you're going to spend more on arms, I think you would have to cut down expenditure to some extent all round. I do think a point that is overlooked sometimes, though, is that out of a total expenditure of about 3,600 million, a 5 or 10% cut in a number of directions produces a very substantial saving. But I think we must take much greater cognizance of priorities. If we put more emphasis on housing, school building would have to be slowed down and made more economical. And I'm quite convinced it can be. I think a lot of it is there in the expense of building schools at this moment.
How do you take that, Crossman?
Well, I think that it came out in a rather harmless form in the end. Again, nobody would disagree that if we can find cuts of 5 to 10%, then let us by all means find them. But I think that you really must find them. It just isn't enough, I don't think, to say, oh, well, 5 to 10% doesn't sound very big. It's a big budget. They must be there somewhere. For instance, you say cuts in school building might be a good thing, might not. Very arguable point. But you won't get any cut of 5% if as rapidly as you decrease school building, you increase the housing paper. No cut at all there. Extra 100,000 houses will cancel out a lot.
Well, of course, you always make the assumption, your Chancellor did this afternoon, that if you're going to have another 100,000 houses, you must cut the capital investment program by the same amount. That I entirely disagree with, because there is already enough labour in the building industry, and I think
adequate materials, except timber, there's certainly enough labor to produce far more houses without diverting any more labor from other capital projects. I think it's a really, not an unfair, but a misleading argument to suggest that more houses means that amount less of other things. It really means using the resources you've got more efficiently.
Oh, well, if you're saying that we're capable of a great increase in the efficiency of the building industry, of course, I entirely agree. I must make the point that it's an entirely private enterprise industry, which is under very little government control indeed. I think it's an industry whose productivity record is extremely bad. I agree with you entirely on that, and I wish we could find some way of increasing its productivity.
Yes, but come again, Mort. I think you want to say something on that.
The difference between the house building industry before the war and since the war, being owned and operated by private enterprise in either case, since the war, entirely to government direction, working almost entirely for local authorities, at productivity, as between those two times, in a private enterprise industry, has fallen by, I think, 15 or 20%. But perhaps we're getting well off the main topic. I'm delighted to follow up housing. I think it would more interest perhaps the domestic listener than anyone else.
I think we're getting off the main point, which is rather a good thing, because I do think that your last remark is at any rate very challenging on the reasons for the fall in productivity. Well, let me come back, if I may, to the main point then. It may well be true that you can build more houses. It may well be true that you can do so without cuts in the non-building industry part of the capital investment program. But of course, you can't build more houses in the short run without cuts somewhere. Now, if you're going to build more houses, all the cuts which you're going to make and which you say we must have are going to go into the extra houses. And what I still want to know is where the cuts are which are going to the extra rearmament as well as the extra houses.
Well, apartments. The direct control, or transfer, direct transfer of physical resources to the armament program will largely be from civilian consumption. These are television sets, pots and pans, motorcars, that sort of thing. The transfer of money from one form of government spending to another would involve cutting out such things as the famous ground nut scheme. I'm sorry to come back to this, but the best part of 30 millions of perfectly good money thrown down the drain. And that is only one example of many. One doesn't know all the examples until you're inside the government and they have access to all the facts. If you study the reports of the Committee on Estimates, you'll find plenty more. Enough, I think, to add up to 100 or 200 million without a great deal of difficulty.
Well, if the ground nut is only one example of many, I'm bound to say the Conservative Party has wasted a great number of opportunities. Because, I mean, it seems to have taken the view on ground nuts that it was a scandal so exceeding any other that it's absorbed the major part of their attention for the last 2 years. I don't think, in fact, that I don't think myself we could now, in the short run, get much saving on ground nuts, of course, because the scheme is being cut down. But what I do think on the general point is that it's a mistake to suppose that even if you can get some more administrative economy, some more efficiency in the government departments, everything like that, I don't believe that the saving which you'll get from that will be quantitatively significant in terms of rearmament.
Can I say the word profits here without provoking violence, Modling? That an idea that commends itself to you at all?
Could there be a cut in profits?
I all for profits, particularly if I can earn them, which I very rarely...
I'm talking about a cut in
profits. A cut in profits?
Yes.
What sort of cut in profits? I'm a strong believer, as I imagine Crosland is too, in competition in private enterprise industry. And I think the best way of restraining profits, insofar as you want them to be restrained, is through competition, which enables the efficient chap to get a big profit and the inefficient chap to go out of business.
Well, I'm merely asking for information, Crosland. Do you think there's anything in the touching profits which might help the rearmament program to be financed?
I certainly think something can and ought to come from profits. I don't think that that's the sole answer to the whole question, but I do think the profits are now very high, I guess. And if Maudling is right, and I agree with him to some extent, that you've got to have some cuts somewhere, he says that the cuts must come out of consumption. Personally, I would much rather that the cuts, if possible, came out of profits. And there's no doubt the profits are far higher now than a year ago, and I do think there's a strong case for increasing profit taxation.
Good. I think your chancellor would be rather disappointed if profits fell, because at least 60%, and I should say in the long run, well over 60% of profits go to the Exchequer to help him pay for rearmament.
That is absolutely true, but the remaining 40% is very big still. And I
doubt if the remaining 40% is adequate to maintain the capital requirements of British industry, and if you want evidence of that, look at the way enormous companies, well-run, efficient companies, are constantly having to go to the capital market to borrow fresh money these days to maintain their own working stocks, maintain their physical assets.
Oh, well, I don't think there's any shortage of capital funds in this country. After all, big companies in this country, in America and everywhere else, have traditionally got their funds by borrowing from the market.
But and indeed, borrowing, they...
No, that's quite true, but they've always borrowed it from the past. There's nothing new in new capital issues. They've been going on since the beginning of time. What is remarkable at the moment is how easily the new capital issues are being financed. The public is lapping them up. And I think that does suggest there's no particular shortage of capital funds in the country.
Well, I noticed that as money seems rather to move out of national savings, it appears to move into industrial issues. But that's rather a controversial point to raise.
Well, now, having started down this slippery slope of controversy, I shall throw all discretion to the winds and shall mention capital levy. Any reaction, Russell?
I think the case for a capital levy at the present moment really is a psychological one. And not an economic one. A capital levy worth from the economic point of view help rearmament a great deal. I would agree with probably what Mortney thinks about that. The psychological case, on the other hand, seems to me irresistible. More so if Maudling is right than I. If he wants cuts in consumption, and if they've got to come, it seems to me that you won't get the national support for the rearmament programme unless you have some sort of levy on capital, which means a levy on the wealthiest people. And I think the psychological case for having and therefore the political case for having some sort of recurrent annual capital levy as long as rearmament goes on is extremely strong.
Do you accept that argument?
Well, I think it's an extremely interesting argument. I gather Crosland agrees, or would agree with me, that the capital levy is economic nonsense, has no relation whatever to the financing rearmament. What, in fact, he's saying is in order to persuade people to pay the taxes that must be paid for rearmament, indirect as well as direct, you have to soak the rich. Well, maybe psychologically that is necessary. I hope it isn't necessary in this country, because I hope people still believe that burdens should be laid on people and taxes levied on them only insofar as that's needed, and not to satisfy, perhaps, the envy of other people who feel they're on a level as they ought to be.
Well, I agree with that, but after all, it's been your main point tonight that there is a burden of rearmament. Well, now, if there is a burden of rearmament, it's just to me a simple matter of social justice that the people who should feel the burden first should be the wealthier people and not the poorer people. And so if there is a burden, and you agree and I agree that there has got to be some burden, we disagree about how much, it seems to me just a matter of simple social justice that the burden should first feel on the people with the large, fall on the people with the large capital fortunes.
Well, if the burden is a question of raising extra taxation and the capital levy doesn't provide the resources for the armament, you're not spreading the burden at all. You're spreading the burden on one hand, on the other hand, you're sucking a chap behind the ear with a club because you think he's better off than he ought to be. It's had no relation on your own admission to the economic side.
Well, now there's going to be one cut made here and now, I'm afraid, and that's a cut in time because we've run out of hours. And I think people who've listened to us will gather that if we've got no shortage of economic problems in Britain, we've got no shortage of remedies either. Whether the body politic can take them all is another matter. It may be that the British people will presently have to choose between the two sets of nostrums that are offered them. You ask me when will that be? Well, that's another debate, I think, in London Forum.
You have been listening to a discussion in the weekly series London Forum, recorded in a studio of the BBC. The speakers were Anthony Crosland and Reginald Maudling, with Edgar Lustgarten in the chair. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.